Hi, it's Diane. Great to be with you. On My Mind this week, I've been talking with Norm Ornstein about dysfunction in Washington for decades. Since arriving in the Capitol in the mid-70s, he's had a front-row seat to the workings of Congress and the presidency. In 2012, he wrote a book called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. But now, he says, the depth of dysfunction has reached levels even he could not have imagined.
I guess the word that would come to mind, Diane, is abysmal. They're not grappling with the major problems that are facing the country.
Then,
don't say a word. If you tell them, they will hurt you or something like that. And then we will be in big trouble. I saw nothing.
Orange is the New Black starts its sixth season on Netflix this weekend. I revisited a 2014 conversation with Piper Kerman, the woman whose memoir inspired the hit TV show. But first, Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Norm, you've been writing about dysfunction in Congress for a long time now. What do you make of the current state of Congress?
I guess the word that would come to mind, Diane, is abysmal in a whole host of ways. I haven't seen a Congress this dysfunctional, and we've had plenty of dysfunctional Congresses. And it's dysfunctional along a whole series of dimensions. One, of course, is that they're not grappling with the major problems that are facing the country. We have a healthcare system, which the president bragged he is delighted to have sabotaged and undermined. They tried feebly to replace it, haven't done it, and we're going to have chaos this fall as a consequence. We know that we've got these trade wars going on, and Congress, which is supposed to have the authority to set trade policy, has done a few angry tweets, and we've had a couple of threats from members saying that they'll hold up judicial nominations, Jeff Flake, for example, but then nothing has come of it. The immigration issue, of course, is getting worse. Now we have an administration that basically hasn't complied with a court order. We have over 700 children who they say will never be returned to their parents because they're not qualified. We have parents who have been deported while the kids are here. The kids have been mistreated horribly. Nothing done about it. We have very little done about the tremendous shifts occurring in the economy. That's one dimension, passing legislation to deal with the problems that we face.
Let me stop you right there. This morning we got news that the GDP has grown to 4.1%. These economic numbers the president is taking full credit for. Why shouldn't he?
Let's face it, any president would be crowing about these numbers.
Of course.
I did notice that the president in his press conference, where he was ecstatic, mentioned that he has done so much better than his two predecessors. But the fact is that 4.1% growth would be fifth in terms of quarters growths under Barack Obama, who came in with an economy in the hole, and the president came in with an economy doing reasonably well. Now, we can't sugarcoat this or do the opposite. 4.1% is a robust number. I kind of expected this for one reason, and it gets back to the Congress.
The tax cut.
Congress passed this ginormous tax cut, a tax cut which didn't reform the tax code at all. There were some really good ideas out there on how to make the corporate tax code work so that you could actually have more investment. They just cut the taxes. What the companies have done is to buy their stock back so that they could raise the prices of the stock. And in the meantime, the executives now have their stock options worth more, even as they got lower rates. We knew that this would produce a kind of sugar high. But that, along with what became very robust spending increases, means that you're stimulating an economy that already was at full employment. And that can provide that short-term growth. But sometime, I don't know whether it'll be within the next year, but not very long thereafter, we know what happens with a sugar high. you come down pretty hard.
Everything the president has done, Republicans cheer him on. Why isn't it that any Republicans other than John McCain are holding him accountable?
And of course, John McCain is not around the Congress to provide that kind of support. But I have to say, even for John McCain and for those who have been outspoken in some ways in criticizing him, Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, every once in a while, Susan Collins, except for John McCain's vote to block the deeply destructive health plan that was coming up, they have all voted for every nominee. That includes people who have proven to be corrupt, who lied to Congress, like Scott Pruitt, who have shown no capabilities to be in their jobs. Most recently, and I think shockingly, every one of them voted for a nominee for the Assistant Attorney General to head the criminal division, a man who had never done a trial, not practiced criminal law, and who had represented Alpha Bank, a notorious Russian bank, for the money laundering and corrupt activities that they'd done. When he came up for his confirmation hearings, he refused to commit to recusing himself from any issue involving Russia. And he will now be in line if the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, is fired.
Do you believe that is going to happen?
I'm scared to death because we know that the Mueller investigation and other investigations are getting closer and closer. And the evidence of obstruction of justice, collusion and the like has mounted. And now we know that Michael Cohen has a mound of evidence, including, of course, audio tapes and emails and other things that could involve the president in past activities of money laundering. So you worry what will happen. But here was a transparent effort to put somebody in place who is not qualified for the job, and they voted for him. I'd mention one other thing in terms of this Congress. The framers recognized full well the danger of a demagogue, a man at the time without principles who could become president. And they consciously built in safeguards to protect the country. Right at the top of the list was an independent Congress. We've had this corruption from Pruitt, from the first Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, from Ben Carson, from Ryan Zinke, from Steve Mnuchin, from Wilbur Ross. No hearings. No hearings on the children being ripped from their families or on the disaster in Puerto Rico, which has resulted in thousands of people dying and an island that is supine at this point. No hearings on the inability to deal with the possibility of pandemics in the country. The oversight capacity, gone. Now, there's one shining exception to that, and I will give props to Richard Burr, the Republican senator from North Carolina, who has worked very closely with Mark Warner, the Democrat from Virginia, on the Senate Intelligence Committee. They've done a dutiful job looking at the Russian involvement in our elections. And then we have a Congress, after it has been proven that the Russians were deeply involved in 2016 and are very much involved in 2018, when resolutions came up to provide funding for election security for November, the Republicans in the House and Senate blocked it. This is just unspeakable.
Back in April, David Brooks wrote a column in the New York Times calling Vladimir Putin the most powerful man on earth. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would at this point. Now, I would also say that there are other leaders, including the Chinese leader, who have gained enormously in power since the Trump administration took office. But Vladimir Putin at this point, and we saw it in Helsinki, we've seen it in the statements made by the Russians since, has a power over Donald Trump.
What kind of power?
Well, we don't know exactly, but it's hard for me to imagine that it doesn't involve having some things on Trump that Trump does not want disclosed. Past behavior, whether it's money laundering or something else, we can only speculate. We don't know.
What do you believe happened at that meeting?
There has to be a reason why Donald Trump would not bring in his Secretary of State, his National Security Advisor, anybody from the intelligence world or anybody except a translator into a one-on-one meeting with Vladimir Putin. And there is no good explanation for it. But the performance at that press conference, the fact that Trump has criticized virtually everybody, including over and over again humiliating our allies and staunch defenders of the West, from Angela Merkel to Prime Minister Trudeau to Macron, the way he humiliated Prime Minister May in Britain and has never said a negative word about Putin, I don't know any other explanation. In the meantime, if you were to look at what Russia's objectives were in terms of the United States, deep discord and tribal divisions in the country at the top of the list, blowing up the Western alliance and undermining NATO right below that, creating a trade war where the focus is on our closest trade partners and allies that could, in the end, cripple the economies in this region, creating some turmoil in the energy markets that would raise the price of oil, which is essential for the Russians. All of those things are on the wish list of Putin, and he's gotten more than he ever could have imagined.
So what do you make of Secretary of State Pompeo's testimony?
Cringeworthy. And I have to say, Pompeo, who's a smart man, who at least I would put on the positive side of the ledger, compared to his predecessor, who went about systematically destroying our diplomatic corps, has at least brought a little bit of esprit back to the State Department and a little bit of spark to diplomacy. But from his time as the head of the CIA, has shown a willingness to fawn over the president. We know that the president, when he brings people in to do job interviews, wants a declaration of personal loyalty. And Pompeo has shown that more than he should. You are, of course, an agent of the president and his policies, but you take an oath not to the president of the United States, but to the Constitution of the United States. When I looked at the exchanges that he had with Senator Menendez, the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, both the arrogance and the unwillingness to be truthful about what he knew about that meeting, private meeting with Putin that the president had, it did not leave me feeling good about the stewardship we have over our country's foreign policy and its interests.
Do you think anyone other than Putin and Trump really know what went on in that meeting?
It's possible, given that, among other things, so many ironies piled upon ironies here, that the president uses an unsecured phone, which he does his on which he does his tweets and uses for phone calls. It's very possible that all kinds of agencies, foreign and domestic, tapped into it. He may have taken that phone in with him. It may be that lots of people know what went on in that meeting, but outside of that, my guess is that the only people who know what went on in that meeting, other than President Trump, Vladimir Putin, and the two translators, is a few other top-ranking officials in the intelligence operation in the Kremlin, and nobody here in the United States.
President Trump went so far this week as to create his own alternative reality by saying, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
And of course, one of the first things that popped up on Twitter was a set of quotes from George Orwell. One of the things that I found most disturbing, Diane, and now we have a slew of books, very good ones by historians and others, some from Europeans who've lived through autocracies, books on how democracies die, books on how autocracies develop. And when you look at those, and I would also include a little bit from the book I did with E.J. Dion and Tom Mann, One Nation After Trump, but when you look at all of those, you have a checklist of things that are a movement away from democracy and towards autocracy.
Such as?
The attacks on the free press, the enemy of the people, a phrase originated by Stalin and dropped by Khrushchev when he became the head of the Soviet Union because it was too dangerous, that the president used again just a week ago. And with that, the attempt to destroy truth, facts, and evidence by saying what's real is not real, what's not real is, and I am the arbiter. And we know, by the way, that we've had surveys with Trump supporters asked what they mean by fake news. Fake news is not lies. It's anything negative about President Trump. And I know from the feedback that I get from some of the things that I've written or said that that's what you get. We also know we are living in a tribal world now with tribal media. And it's not just President Trump, because another factor as you see a move away from democracy and towards authoritarian structures is control of the mass media. And the fact is the president has enablers in Fox News, in talk radio, whether it is Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh or Laura Ingraham, the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, or Alex Jones. We have large numbers of people who get all their information from those sources, and it is not an accurate picture of what's going on.
So does that mean that publications like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, the LA Times, are they not doing a good enough job? Or is it simply that Trump supporters want to ignore everything that's written in those publications or that's on CNN?
I think the president's efforts to discredit CNN, the New York Times, and other entities like that has had its impact. But there are large numbers of people in the country who don't read or look at those things anyhow. Now, I would give props to the Post and the Times. And the attacks on those papers are unsettling. And we know that what's happening in the newspaper world more generally is a problem. But thanks to terrific owners of some of the major entities who are courageous, they're standing firm and doing what they should be doing. Now, I do think, however, there is still a tendency among many in what we call the mainstream media, and it's hard for them to get away from it, of a both sides kind of false equivalence. It's very hard for them to attack one side without saying, yeah, but the other side does it too. And we still see more of that, I think, than we should. And that has contributed, I believe, over the last number of years to a lot of the bad behavior that we've seen. Because if you don't call out bad behavior for what it is, then people get away with it.
So what are you saying, that the Times, the Post, other publications should do away with? Well, on the other hand,
It's deeply ingrained in journalistic culture, first of all, that you report both sides of a story.
Right.
But not every story has two sides.
Right.
Sometimes there are 10 sides, but sometimes there's one. There's also, I think, this deep-seated tendency in a media that has been criticized for decades for being the liberal media, and some of that criticism is justified, that they bend over triply backwards so that it doesn't look like they are biased against Republicans or conservatives. And here, too, that tendency means that they don't report reality often as bluntly as they should. That's changing now, because when you've been hit in the face over and over again with corruption, with lies, with the dismissal of science and facts, with the rupture of norms of conduct, of behavior, and that includes not just Trump and the Trump administration. A lot of it goes to what I would see with the abject dismissal of their fiduciary responsibilities by Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, and by the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and the other leaders. When that happens over and over again, you can't just keep doing, well, they all do it.
Are you concerned about the stability, the ongoingness of our democratic system?
I'm deeply concerned, far more than I have been at any point in my lifetime. Now, you know, with a caveat, I was here back in the early 1970s. I was there when President Nixon fired Archibald Cox.
So was I.
When we had not been through an impeachment before, when we didn't know if the system would survive.
Right.
And we had not only safeguards in place, but we had courageous statesman-like figures like Hugh Scott, the Senate Republican leader, and Howard Baker, and Barry Goldwater, and John Rhodes, the Republican leader in the Senate, and Bill Cohen, a young member on the Judiciary Committee in the House, who stepped up to the plate. I don't see a Hugh Scott or a Howard Baker or a John Rhodes or any of the others now. There are people who have said that if social media and tribal media had been around in the Nixon era, he would have stayed as president throughout his term. Things have changed, but the norms have just been shredded in so many ways. And from the attacks on the independent judiciary to the stacking of the judiciary, from the attacks on the free press, on science, the undermining of the federal bureaucracy, the cult of personality, only I can fix it, and the lack of pushback from the Congress, the degree to which we are now divided in the country in tribal ways, it's a worrisome time. And on the other side of the ledger is that we have seen a jolt in media operations like The Post and The Times that have upped their game, in civic organizations, lawyers stepping up to help out with the immigration issue or with the children, these groups that are trying to reform our system so that we can make democracy work. There are real challenges there. I want to add one other element to that, though, Diane. We have a set of structures put in place by the framers at a time that required a lot of balancing to bring states into the union, but also at a time when the difference in population between the largest and smallest states was about 16 to 1. Now it's over 70 to 1. There's a figure I use in every speech I give now that I find deeply unsettling. By around 2040, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. People are moving to the states where there's economic vibrancy and jobs. And that means 30% of Americans will elect 70 senators, enough to override vetoes, enact treaties, do almost anything that they want. Now, we've always had an imbalance, and the smaller states have been given a little more clout here. But that gap is growing. And the biggest problem is that the 30% are going to be largely unrepresentative of the changes occurring in the country. They're not going to be from the most economically vibrant areas that are responding to the global economy. They're not going to represent the diversity of the country. They're going to be a little bit older, more male, significantly more white. And we can't say that all of those senators are simply going to represent those interests. But there's going to be a growing sense of illegitimacy that people feel. At the same time, the Electoral College has become very much imbalanced. And the House of Representatives, which is supposed to be the body reflecting popular opinion, with so much of what's happened with not just partisan gerrymandering, but people concentrating in the urban areas, that it no longer reflects broader public opinion. And if we chip away, even if we, you know, live through the Trump era, so many of these problems go way beyond Donald Trump himself.
Norm, you have a nightmare scenario. Tell us about it.
I don't like to give people nightmares, but as I thought about worst-case scenarios, there are really two. One, of course, is that we end up in a war. In Iran, very possibly down the road with North Korea, but a real war. But the main one is, as the Mueller investigation gets closer and closer, and as the evidence mounts, and now with Trump's longtime accountant, who's now been subpoenaed to appear in front of a grand jury, who knows an awful lot about the transfers of money to pay off the women, with all of that, that Trump is going to fire Mueller one way or the other and everybody around him, pardon himself and everybody around him. And a pardon, self-pardon, will ultimately have to be decided by a Supreme Court that I fear would accept it. But more than that, then call on his supporters to take to the streets, saying this is a coup attempt. The deep state and Hillary Clinton are trying to steal the election I won fair and square. Take to the streets to support our democracy. And they'll go out there, some of them with their assault weapons, and we could have clashes and bloodshed. And then we get martial law, a suspension of civil liberties, and a lot of other things that go along with it. Now, I'm not saying that is a likelihood, but I don't think it is a fanciful hypothesis at this point. One thing that I've learned from reading all these books about what happened in the 1930s, about what happened with Turkey, now what's going on in many of the countries of the former Soviet bloc and Eastern Europe, the step-by-step slide towards something more authoritarian is not something that we can feel could never happen here. And we're closer to seeing some of those elements. They have to be a wake-up call for all of us. You know, one of the things, too, over the last several decades, we have built even more enormous power into the president and the presidency, built on the assumption that a president would always put the interests of his country first. We didn't think through, I think, carefully enough what happens if you have a president who doesn't meet those tests. And that, with foreign policy, control of nuclear weapons, the ability to go to war, and the ability to use the levers of power to stay in power, that's something that's deeply unsettling to me.
Norman Ornstein, I don't know whether to thank you or not for that outlook.
Have a nice day.
I do want to thank you for being here.
Diane, I have to say again, as I have said so many times, that throughout the last several decades with the radio show and now with the podcast, with the books you've done, you have been a role model for civil discourse, deep analysis, and for what journalism ought to be in a free society. So I thank you, too.
Thank you. That was Norman Ornstein. His most recent book is titled One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Now a quick break. When we come back, a conversation with Piper Kerman. And we're back. Piper Kerman joined me on the Diane Rehm Show back in June 2014, just after the release of Orange is the New Black's second season. She talked about what it was like to see her story brought to life on screen and how her time behind bars turned her into a prison rights activist. Here's an excerpt from that conversation. Piper Kerman, it's good to meet you.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Hi, Diane. It's good to meet you, too.
And for our listeners who may not know, Piper, tell us how you ended up as an inmate in a Connecticut prison.
When I walked in my college graduation at Smith College in 1992, I was part of a very fortunate group of young women. That was the first women's institution in whose walls I lived. And I walked out into a surprisingly uncertain future despite having, you know, a college degree in hand and many advantages behind me. I didn't really know what my next step was. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I drifted a bit. And it was that point in my life when I crossed paths with an older woman and she seemed very sophisticated and very worldly to me. And she was, in fact, very worldly. She was involved in narcotics trafficking. And rather than run in the other direction, I followed her around the globe.
So you knew right from the start that she was involved in narcotics.
She revealed that to me very early.
I see.
And yeah, I should have self-preservation should have kicked in, but instead I followed her to Bali and to Zurich and all kinds of places that seemed very exciting to me. And
how long a period were you with her?
Less than a year. The day came, of course, that I could no longer sort of hold myself apart from what was happening around me. And that was the day that she asked me to carry a bag of money from Chicago to Brussels. And she said, you know, I really need you to do this. And she was scared. And so I was scared, too. And I carried the bag of money. And after I did that, I was even more scared because I knew that I had crossed this bright line and I had broken the law in a really serious way. And so about a month after I carried that bag of money, I ended that relationship. I made my way back to the United States. I sort of broke all ties with my ex-lover and these other people. And I moved forward with my life, and I was lucky to be able to do that. But the consequences of our actions come back to us sooner or later. And in my case, in 1998, federal agents knocked on my door. I was living in New York then with my then-boyfriend, Larry Smith. And they said, you've been indicted in federal court, and you better get ready to face the consequences of your past choices.
And what about your boyfriend? Did he know of your past activities?
No, he knew nothing. And so literally that day, the two federal agents sort of said, would you like to make a comment? And I said, I think I'd better talk to a lawyer. And then I went tearing off to talk to Larry, and the whole crazy story came tumbling out. And he really, at first, he thought I was making an elaborate joke. He was just like, what? What are you talking about? And he was really remarkable. He stood by me the whole way in a way that was very profound and very sustaining.
So you were indicted in 1998, mm-hmm. but you did not actually go to prison until 2004.
Correct.
How come?
There was a series of legal delays which were caused by the U.S.'s efforts to extradite a drug kingpin from overseas, which they failed to do. So eventually in 2003, they began to proceed sending folks to prison who were on my indictment. So in February of 2004, I turned myself in at the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut, to begin serving a 15-month sentence.
Piper, talk about your feelings on that day.
Well, Larry and I made the drive from New York City, where we live, up to Connecticut. And when we arrived at the facility in Danbury, the first thing that I saw was this towering, incredibly vicious-looking triple-layer razor wire fence. And I just looked at that fence, and I'd really tried to prepare myself for that experience over the, you know, close to 6 years that I'd been waiting to go to prison. But I remember looking at that fence and saying, oh, wait, I thought I was going to be in a minimum security prison. I was really scared. And when I walked through that fence, through chamber after chamber, and the fence is slamming behind you, that's the moment that you're like, there's no escaping from what I face.
Piper, where were your parents in all this?
My parents were an incredible source of strength to me. They were shocked and stunned back in 1998 when I called them and said, this is what's happening. But they were, of course, incredibly worried, and they just were very forgiving to me, for which I'm very grateful, and really, really were an incredible lifeline while I was incarcerated. And that is true for all incarcerated people. Their family and their friends on the outside are really important lifelines. That's one of the things that helps you do the time, is knowing that there's people on the outside who have a stake in your survival and a stake in your success.
And, of course, you've written this book as not only a memoir, but really trying to help others understand what that whole experience is like and to help the general public understand what prison life, especially for women, is like.
Mm, absolutely. Even from the first day in prison, it was clear to me that the experience was not going to be what I expected. The image of prisons and of prisoners in this country is of relentless violence, uncontrollably violent people in uncontrollably violent places, and that was not my experience. I thought that if I told the story well of my own experience and the way my life intersected with other women's while I was locked up, that people might come away from the book with a different idea about who is in prison, for example, women, and why they're there, and what really happens to people behind prison walls.
But now your message really has become, we've got to take a closer look at what's going on behind these walls and behind these bars.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. Our current situation of having the world's biggest prison population and the biggest prison population in human history, really, that's a relatively new phenomenon. That's over the last 30 years that we have grown our prison population from 500,000 people in 1980 to 2.4 million people behind bars today. And women have been the fastest growing part of that population. 800% increase in the incarceration of women.
Why do you think that is?
That has been overwhelmingly driven by drug sentencing. The very same mandatory minimum laws that sent me to prison sent millions of other people to prison, including a disproportionate number of women.
Nonviolent women.
Two-thirds of women in prison have committed nonviolent offenses. And that's a shame because most of those women are moms. And, you know, when you incarcerate a mother, it has this seismic effect on her family. The children of incarcerated moms are five times more likely to go into the foster care system than the children of incarcerated dads. And believe me, losing a dad into the prison system is very devastating for a family. But to lose a mother has this effect on those kids and on those communities, which is really, really profound.
Here is an email from A.H., who's in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. She says, I can't help but wonder why Ms. Kerman was sentenced to 13 months in prison while Kemba Smith, a young black woman who also became involved in the drug trade through a romantic relationship, was sentenced to 24 and a half years in prison. Does Ms. Kerman have any idea why that disparity came about?
So the very first night that I went to sleep in prison, I went to sleep saying, I am so lucky. I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky. And I was saying that because I felt like I'm so lucky I'm only spending 1 year in this horrible place. During that course of that first afternoon in general population, I had met, you know, what seemed like hundreds, but it was probably dozens of women. And the acceptable icebreaker in prison is not, why are you here? It is, how much time do you have? So people would ask me that, and I would sort of quaver back to them that I had a 15-month sentence, and they would immediately start calculating what would I get off for good behavior, which, you know, would take me down to 13 months. And then I would squeak back, well, how much time do you have? And some of those women were doing short time, like I was, but a lot of those women were doing much longer sentences, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years longer. So as the days and the months went on, and I grew to know those other women very well, you know, prisons and jails are close quarters. You will get to know people well whether you like it or not. But I did. I grew to know all these other women very well. It was impossible to draw the conclusion that their crimes, for those women who were doing far more time than I was, that their crimes were so much more serious than my crime. You could only draw the conclusion that they had been treated differently by the criminal justice system because of socioeconomics and in some cases because of the color of their skin. And you don't need to hear that anecdotally from me because the data supports the point that different Americans will be policed differently, they will be prosecuted differently, and they will be sentenced differently.
Did you ever expect, as you wrote this book, that somehow it could or would evolve into what millions of people are now watching?
I think that every writer has to fantasize finding an audience, because otherwise you couldn't go on. You'd never finish writing anything. But the evolution, the adaptation of the book into a show, which I think is a really strong, really amazing adaptation, that far exceeds anything that I could have imagined.
The animals, trap, trap, trap till the cages fall. The cages fall, the day is new, and everyone is waiting, waiting on you, and you've got time.
That was Piper Kerman, author of the memoir Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. One last note. We're going to take a break next month. We'll be on a hiatus for the month of August, and we'll be back with you on Friday, September 7th, with a new episode. We hope you'll join us then. That's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Natalie Yoreblipker. Thanks for listening. Have a great August. I'm Diane Rehm.